Hello, my name is Nati Shalom, and I'm from GigaSpaces. With me is Shai Banon, who is our leading architect. And what we'll do today, the main theme of this presentation would be to talk about how we move from a tier-based approach to a service approach. And basically, I wouldn't say that the service approach is the important part of that, but how do we get our existing tier-based application and move that to a point where we could really scale it out, even if it's stateful. Stateful meaning that the data sits in the business tier. And we'll talk about how we combined things like data grid and also things like scaling out approach. And we'll utilize Spring as a way to simplify all that. So the nice thing that you will see is that you could really get to the point where you could write once, as I call it, and then scale it anywhere without changing your code. So that would be another part of that theme. In terms of the schedule, we'll do that in several parts. The first one will be talking about the challenges that actually move us to think in those terms. And then we'll talk about an approach that is generic. And we'll see what are the patterns that we utilize and we experienced that worked for us to get to that point. Later on, we'll actually go and take a more deep dive, and Shai Banon will actually show a real demo. We'll actually run an application and show you how it could scale across multiple machines. In this case, we'll run it on a single machine, but it will simulate a scaling of multiple machines. And we'll leave 10 minutes towards the end for questions. So we have a lot of things to cover, and I think that putting those questions along at the end of the presentation should be sufficient enough. In any case, those that wouldn't get their answer covered, we have a booth there, and you could always stop by our booth and ask questions. So these are basically the goals of these presentations and what we want to do and what we want to achieve. And if we'll skip to the next slide. A few words about GigaSpaces. How many people are familiar with GigaSpaces here? Heard the name? Raise their hands. Oh, there are quite a few. GigaSpaces is actually there for quite some time, I think starting from 2000. Many people know us by the JavaSpaces background, hence the name. We've grew a lot from that point, and as you would see today, we're dealing not just with the JavaSpaces part of our product, which we utilize extensively, but also how we deal with the problem that we're actually presenting today. So obviously there is a close proximity between what we're saying and what we're actually doing. The core part of our product is built on two layers. One of them is the data grid layer, which is built on top of a space model. And on top of that, we have an application service grid, which deals with how we build the application on top of that data grid in order that we'll be able to address the scaling out of the entire application. These are the two parts of our product, and we'll utilize that as part of the demo. We have an interesting set of customers already. Hundreds of customers are using the technology already, mostly in the financial industry, the most high-end type of application. Interestingly enough, we are in the process of actually running some of the casinos here on top of that model. So obviously on the next conference, you'll see some new machines running here on the instead of the actual machine that you're seeing right now, much more sophisticated with video streaming and things of that line. And that would be running on top of GigaSpaces. So that's something that is actually being worked out these days. So that's pretty much the customer base and the spread of application that we're dealing with. Again, the type of problems that you'll be seeing that we're addressing is something that is growing pretty rapidly today beyond the financial market. If we look at the classical tier-based application, one that exists in the financial industry, but as well as in any other industry, we see several parts that are very commonly in most of those applications. We have the feeds. The feeds are the data source, and the data source could be a user interacting with a system, but today we could have a lot of cases in which we have a system interacting with a system, whether it's by loading data for a file or by actually interacting through a JMS feed, which generate a lot of the events from that other system to my system. So a feed could be relatively every data source. And we have a continuous flow of data or burst of data that is coming depending on the data source itself. And usually on the business theory, what we have is some sort of a workflow to deal with that events and data. The workflow usually includes several steps. The generic one would be parsing that data, getting that raw data, making it something that is more useful for my business, enriching it. Then after we pass that validation, we're doing something with the data. In a trading application, normally that process would be the actual match between the trade and the existing bids in the system. And then we're doing the actual routing or execution, meaning that we're executing the request and we're completing that. If we think about the some interesting terminology, the end-to-end scaling or end-to-end latency, as we call it, from a latency perspective, what we normally see is that the event flow is such that it goes from the messaging system and then go through the steps between the messaging system to the database. So eventually what we have is a message going on, going through step A, then it goes to the database to maintain the state related to that step A, which will be the parsing, for example. Then we trigger another event through the messaging system to start another step, which will be the matching, for example, which will end by updating that state of that event in the database as well, and going forth to step C, and obviously in a real-life application, we could have multiple steps. The impact of that in terms of latency is the end-to-end latency. The time it takes for us to complete the entire transaction will be very much dependent on the amount of those steps and the amount of interaction between the messaging, the business logic, and the data in each step. So the end-to-end latency would be the summation of the time it takes to do step A, step B, and step C. And again, it will be very much dependent on all the tiers that are involved in that execution of that transaction. Now, that's one problem, because one of the problems here is that if we really want to scale and add more steps, we really linearly add the latency, increase the latency. If we think about those type of systems and we add scalability to that, what we really want in terms of scalability is the ability to take that system and get to the point where if one installation deals with 1,000 transactions per second, while we could plug in another machine, it will be able to handle 2,000 transactions per second without changing my architecture, without impacting the actual business or correctness of the application. That's really what scaling is. And without impacting the latency. That's what we want to deal with when we deal with scalability. Obviously, in real life, in many cases, we do a lot of compromise when we actually deal with those problems, but that's really the end goal. The end goal is that we'll be able to take that application and just by adding another instance of that application, we'll be able to deal with linear scalability of the amount of transactions that we can handle. If you look at the bottlenecks in that architecture, obviously there are several bottlenecks in each tier. The messaging is built as a central server in many cases. Obviously, there's been some progress in that regard. There's been, again, the multiple steps overhead. And also the database overhead, which is pretty obvious. It's a centralized place where everyone, even though we scale, and I think maybe some of you heard the AMDA law. The AMDA law basically talks about the point where even though we could add more instances, even if we have 10% of our code synchronized in a single contention, if we'll increase the number of instances of our application or the scale of our application by a factor of 100, we'll achieve only 10 of that number. I will scale only by a factor of 10 and not by a factor of 100. So that's really the, and all of that is because of the synchronization. The fact that we have a single contention that all those multiple units start to synchronize with. And obviously database would be a large part of that contention. So we'll have to address that as well. But the bigger problem, if we think about scaling, and if we really think about the end goal, how we get to the point where we could really add another instance of machine and scale my entire application, is within the architecture itself. The fact that we're thinking in tiers. When we think in tiers, we actually build each tier in a way that it will handle the high availability of its own, the scalability of its own, without relying on the other tier. And therefore, we have a lot of moving parts. Moving parts would be that the messaging system has its own high availability system and scaling system, and therefore, if it needs to maintain redundancy, you'll need, for every message that goes to the systems, go to a backup system. Then we have the same thing for the sessions within the business tiers. as well as with the database. So for every transaction, we're doing a message, going to the back end of that messaging system, going to the business tier, going to the backup of that business tier, going to the database, going to the backup of the business tiers. Now, if you start to add more instances like that, obviously, you start to see a huge mesh, and that's really the main problem. And scalability, the nice thing about scalability, or the interesting thing, I wouldn't say nice, is the fact that you could be as strong as your weakest link. And it's very hard to get to the point where you could really scale linearly without addressing all those issues. That's really the challenge. You could solve several issues, but you can't really scale linearly. And the goal, and what I'm going to present, is how we scale linearly, how we can guarantee that we can scale linearly, what are the principles to get to that point. So obviously, one of the patterns that we all heard is that we need to move from that application-centric, tier-based approach to a service-oriented pool. Okay, you could see in the picture itself, you could see that the picture looks cleaner when you move to that world, but there is a big question mark here. How do we do that? Okay, everyone heard those buzzwords, and usually when we hear about SRA, we think about web services, but if you even try to put web services in that world, obviously you wouldn't be solving any problem. I would say, in the optimistic case, in the reality, it would even add more problems. So how do we move from that world to that world in the right way? How do we really utilize the SOA concept in the correct way that will get me to the point where I can scale linearly? That's really the first question that we want to answer. And let's see a typical example of how we deal with that today and how we could do that better. Skip that slide. So basically what we have today is usually we have the term ASB, and what we normally educated to do is have a loosely coupled services instead of application-centric. So we could have the same services hanging on that kind of virtual bus, which becomes the messaging system, and they communicate not directly with the feed or with the end users, they communicate through that bus. That allows me to add another unit very easily, if you'll click on the next slide, and spread the load between those different units without, again, changing my code. The problem in that world is there are two types of interesting challenges in that solution. One of them is the messaging itself. It needs to be scalable, obviously, meaning that it needs to be built in a way that will be virtualized rather than centralized. The other challenge, and that's even the bigger challenge, is that our application is not really stateless. We use the word stateless in many cases when we think about scalability, but what we really mean by that is that the state doesn't sit in the business logic tier. It actually sits in the database. So there is a state somewhere. We just ignore it. So there is no such thing as stateless applications, even in the SOA world. Or I wouldn't even say more in the SOA world. And therefore, I'm limited as my weakest link. So how do we solve that? This is where the space model comes into place, JavaSpaces. How many people are familiar with JavaSpaces, heard the name? Okay, actually quite a few. So the nice thing, without going too much into the details, and I can spread the entire just session just talking about JavaSpaces and what it really means and the philosophy behind it, the main principle that I want to focus here is the fact that it doesn't separate between the state, i.e. the data, and the messaging. There is four verbs, write, read, take, and notify, that combines the messaging and the data into one runtime technology, one sort of set of APIs. That's really the value that the space model can bring into that world. So if we look at that picture, we could use those four APIs, the write, read, and take, and notify, the same way that we would use with an ASB. Instead of using a send and receive, we'll use a take and a write. A take to receive the object, and a write to send the message. The nice thing, the take could be blocking, and therefore we could, by doing a take with a blocking timeout, we're actually doing a subscribe. It's a very simple way to do that. The take itself also has some semantics to do query, which enable me to do an associative routing, content-based routing. Again, in a very simple way, only four APIs. Now, the other part of that is that I can use that same four APIs, if you click, to share state, the same runtime. The only difference is that I'll use the write and the read to access the object, and I wouldn't really delete them once I consume that. That's really the only difference. So the only difference would be the life cycle of the object between the messaging scenario and the data sharing scenario, but the runtime itself would remain the same. That's the main principle here. So by utilizing the space in that world, I can address those two things without adding more moving parts into my application, and that's why we've chosen the space as the means to implement the pattern that I'm going to introduce in a second. So obviously, if we implement the space model as a centralized server, then it will become the bottleneck. So let's see what we're doing with that. So coming back to that same scaling picture of that ESB, we could do the same thing with the space. The only difference is that we will be utilizing the take and the notify and the write instead of send and receive. And the fact that the space implementation can be virtualized, i.e. can span across multiple machines virtually, meaning that my application code doesn't know which physical instance it actually interacts with. There is a separation between the actual API that I'm utilizing and the actual physical instances over the network. I can scale only even on that level linearly without creating more contention. The other part of that is I can do the same thing with the data. So the scaling becomes consistent. I don't add other moving parts. They're all referenced to that same kind of cloud. And therefore, I don't introduce bottlenecks once I add more instances. They grow together. From a deployment perspective, and that's one of the challenges in any service architecture, once I build services, there is one contradiction that led me to build my application for the sake of separation of concerns in a very fine-grained level. I want every component in my application to become a service. When it comes to deployment, that actually doesn't make a lot of sense, because if I'll take every service and start to communicate through the bus for that specific service, that will create a lot of overhead, and that's part of the reason why a lot of projects have failed when they start to move to SLA. That same realization. So the question is, how do I build those type of services in a way that would be fine-grained to get to that level of separation of concerns, but without creating the overhead of the interaction between those services? And that's something that we call a processing unit. So we're separating between the business logic unit, which is fine-grained, and the scaling unit and the failover unit. So the scaling unit would be a bigger unit and will include the data and the business logic and the messaging all in a single VM. The reason why we're doing that is we're doing that because we want to build the system in a way that will be self-sufficient. And that's the main principle to achieve linear scalability. I would even say differently. We can achieve linear scalability only if we could get to that self-sufficient unit. Only if we will have units that would be independent of the other, and therefore, while adding another one, I would really get the extra capabilities, in this case, in terms of throughput, without affecting the other units of my application. So I have to get to the point where they're self-sufficient. In order that they would be self-sufficient, I need to have everything that is required to fulfill the request of the end user within that same process or same VM. So what we've done is we bundle them together, condense them in memory, the data and the messaging, and then what we do is we partition them. And in that case, we spread the load between the machines, between the processing unit themselves. So that's pretty much the basic principle of the processing unit. We separate between the fine-grained approach of services and the scaling unit, which is more looking at the scaling from a different dimension, the dimension of the actual transaction of the request. What is the what part of the messaging needs to sit and the same VM, and what part of the data needs to be there in order to fulfill that request? Okay, so that's a very important principle. We'll see an example of that in a second. The nice thing about that, before we'll move to the example, coming back to the tier-based approach, if you look at that from a different dimension, what we've done here, we still have those tiers existing somewhere in my application from at least architecture perspective. The only difference is they become a virtual entity. That's really the main difference. In the classic tier-based approach, the implementation itself enforced an implementation of the tiers as real physical units that I have to bundle. In this case, we actually virtualized the tiers, and therefore we could actually build the application almost in a similar way to the way we've built them today, in a more event-driven way, as we will see, but the concept would remain pretty much close to what we've used to. At the implementation, that's going to change dramatically. It's the middleware stack that is going to change dramatically. So if we look at an application, a typical application with that workflow, how would we build them? The first thing that we will do is we'll build the service components. In our case, it will be a set of podgers. We'll utilize the space to craft the workflow between them. Okay, so we'll use the write and take API to communicate between those different services. And in that case, this would be the mean in which they would remain loosely coupled. They wouldn't know about the existing of each other, and they wouldn't really rely on the existing of each other. It will be more a runtime thing on how we bundle them together. The second part that we will do is we actually bundle them together in the same VM. That will become our processing unit. And interestingly enough, if you think about the latency dimension, on the latency part, because all the workflow is in memory, we're getting very, very low workflow, even if we add steps into my workflow. Unlike the previous approach, if you remember, that every step that we added to the workflow introduced another override of messaging and data. In this case, it's all in memory, and therefore we don't introduce the override, and the latency becomes pretty consistent, even if we scale the system. And from a scalability perspective, it's very easy to scale. All I need to do, because each unit is self-sufficient, is just add more units, and that's all. So if I'll sum that up in a nutshell, there are several interesting aspects that we're getting by moving to that approach. They are laid out in that slide. The main one is the fact that we could really build our application in a single unit, in a single VM, and then scale it without worrying on changing my code if I'm running in a low-scale application, because I don't really know at the beginning if I really need that level of scalability at day one. So in that case, I don't need to be worried about all that. And also from the deployment perspective, we could really deploy those different units in a single operation across multiple machines without knowing which machine I'm interacting with. It's all going to be virtualized. How do we do that? We introduce a lightweight container approach. Skip that. And basically, the principle is pretty simple. Instead of having the user interacting with the actual machines, it's interact with some component that knows about the machines on his behalf. So the user doesn't know anything or doesn't interact with any instance beyond that instance. And that instance would actually pass the request. In this case, the request would be deploy my application. My SLA of my application is that if there is a failure event, make sure that there is at least a binary and a backup running in my application at each point of time, as long as there are enough resources available to it. The resources that that application needs to be running needs to have Oracle or whatever, version 1.6 of JVM running on that machine. All of that become kind of a declarative SLA that I apply to my system, and then I click on deploy, and once I do the deployment, the matchmaking between the actual resources and the application that needs to run on those resources is done in the middleware stack. And that's how I get the virtualization. I can very easily use that model to say, deploy my application on the QA units. That's a very kind of common pattern or common use case. Or deploy it in my production system without really referencing to the actual machine themselves or knowing where they are, which means for the operation guys that I could change the machines without affecting any of the end users utilizing those machines. So that's the SLA-driven container model, lightweight container model. So how do we deal with failover, for example? If one of the instances fails, obviously, the manager knows that the SLA defines that there needs to be at least a primary and a backup running. It knows that there is another machine available there in the network, and what it will do is we'll do a relocation. It will move that instance into that other machines. What I get as a result of that is a continuous high availability of my application. It will continuously and proactively handle the failure. So this is really the component of the solution in a very generic terms. We're going now to dive into a more deep dive into the actual code and the implementation, how that application looks like. And that's going to be led by Shai Banon. But I think that the principles are pretty straightforward. The thing is that we still maintain the loose coupling of my application and get the reliability. And the biggest value that we get out of that is it becomes significantly simpler than what we used to have today. And the simplicity is part of the main value of that. The other value that we get is the consistent scalability, the true linear scalability, as well as very low latency, because we're utilizing the in-memory capacity that we have today in our system. We don't, in most systems that utilize databases, for example, we can't really utilize the memory in an efficient way. Because we can utilize in that approach memory in a very efficient way, we could improve the latency significantly and the performance and reduce the overhead, meaning that a single machine could do what most of the machines today would do in 10 instances or even a bigger machine. So that I would say the immediate benefit that you get out of that. At that point, I think I'll let Shai Banon take the deep dive and show you the actual code implementation. So if there is any question, small one, actually, we can take it now before we move to Shai. Okay, Shai.
Okay. So the question is, how do we take these ideas, these really cool ideas, and make them a reality and actually simplify the way that we try to develop this processing unit concept and the ability to cluster or scale out them. So the first thing that we try to do is we try to find a way for us to be able to define the different business logics or space instances and other aspects. And the first thing that we thought about was Spring, because how many people here use Spring? I'm already know the answer. Yeah, okay. So Spring makes your life very simple in terms of assembling beans and in terms of defining the relationship between them. It also makes your life very simple when you want to add transactional support, declarative transactions, and aspect-oriented programming. And we at GigaSpaces really like Spring, and we wanted and we know that most of the users also like Spring, so we wanted to combine the two together. So if we take this processing unit example, which Nati talked about, so we have all these different parts of the processing units. We have the space itself, which is actually the top part and the lower bottom. We're actually using the same space. We just give it different natures by the way that we interact with it. And we have our business logic. Now, we all like Spring for one of the reasons is because Spring allows us to take our business logic and just write it, just focus on our business logics and all the different aspects, all the fact that it's running under a transaction, the fact that we need monitoring on top of it. All these different aspects actually are done by Spring in a declarative manner, either using annotations or using different Spring configuration. So we wanted the users to have the same thing. So in terms of GigaSpaces, the space is actually something that can exist within the processing unit. The fact that you're using the space, we can try and hide it from you. Not because we don't believe that you need to know about the fact that you're running with a space, but because this makes it more testable. You can mock test it and so on. And this is what we try to do. We also identify the fact that there are a lot of common interactions that you do with the space. The common one is the two operations that you see here. So one of them is, how do I get notified when something happened in the space, a new message arrived or something like that? So there are two ways in the space to do that. Either I do a blocking take, or I get notified, register an interest in a certain data that I want to be notified when something changed. So we know users use this all the time, and we wanted to provide components that already do that. They already provide the ability to perform all these operations. Same goes for write. So I'm writing my business logic. I want to get all the features of the space, but without really as less interaction as possible with the space, just because we like it. So this is the first thing that we did. We actually built components within Spring. We extended Spring. If anybody knows here, JMS, the JMS support in Spring 2.0. So it's very similar to that. So yeah, we have containers, and they notify your business logics, which is usually unaware of the space. You perform an operation, and the result is usually written back to the space. We'll see how we do it in a minute. We'll see some code examples. By the way, all this stuff is under a project that we call Open Spaces. Now, one of the reasons why we call it Open Spaces is because the source is probably is going to be included with this Buddhist project. The main reason behind it is these are components that we found out that are the most common ones. We know that our users will probably start to enhance our components. They will start to build their own components, and we hope to get a community around common usage patterns within when using GigaSpaces. So what do we gain by doing that? We talked about it. So testability, this is a very important aspect. So I want, for when I try to test my application, the first thing that I want to do is mock testing or unit testing. So I want to get my business logic and see that I can order a process a trade correctly without any interactions with the space. The next level of testing is integration testing. So I want to be able to take this processing unit, if you want, run it within my IDE, using Spring Mock or some other, or JUnit TestNG with Spring Mock, and just run my Spring application context and see that things are working. The next level is then I want to run the actual processing unit as if it will run in my production system within my IDE, so I'll be able to debug it and test it and see that things are working using different topologies, primary partitions, backup. And the last one is that then I'll be able to deploy it either locally on my machine or within my production, pre-production environment. So how does this work? So usually when we try to design an application, and that's not necessarily a GigaSpace or a space-based application, the first thing that we usually do is we define our domain model. This is the core of our application. This is what we're going to talk to our analysts, our business users, and this is the language that we interact with them. So we build our POJO domain model. The second step that we do, and this is actually the POJOs that are going to be written to the space. So GigaSpaces support the POJO model in terms of writing objects, pure Java objects, to the space. This will be our data. This can also act as messages. So the data is the message as well. The next thing that we usually do is we define our business services. Pure business services that only know are aware of how am I going to process my business logic, I'm getting a trade, two orders, for example, I'm getting orders to my business logics and the result of it is a trade. So I want to write a business logic that does that. And then we want to start worrying about how we're going to wire all these things together. So how are we going to wire my domain model, my interaction with different space aspects, the in-memory data grid, the messaging. How am I going to add transaction support for it? Things are going to have to work under transactions sometimes. And the last step is packaging. So I want to take this thing that I did, assemble it together into a processing unit archive, if you want, and then basically bundle it together and be able to deploy this thing either within my IDE, even I just want to run it within my IDE, or take it and deploy it into our service, our application service grid or something like that without changing the code. Because we are aware of the fact that when you do the steps that are required from the processing unit leaving your IDE and getting to productions are a lot of steps. And we allow for things to be changed externally. So you're using the same package, the same processing unit, and you just move it from your IDE to smoke testing, to pre-production, and then to production just by changing external parameters. So let's have a look at our POJO. So this is a very abstract example. It doesn't have any business nature to it because we try to focus on our features rather than the business behind any business reasoning behind it. So we have a very simple class called Data. We mark it as a space class. This tells the space that that's going to be an object that is going to be saved in the space. We give it an ID. You don't have to give us an ID to the space, but if you want to perform updates, for example, then we need to know what the ID is in order to perform the updates themselves. And another interesting thing is the space routing. Now, the first thing that a lot of people ask is, okay, I got 50 gigs of data. They're not going to... You won't be able to handle them within a single JVM. So the way to solve it is by partitioning the data. So we take the data, we partition it. Usually our business logic is encapsulated within the processing unit and handles only the part of the partitioning that it works with. And the way that we decide how to partition the data is usually by the user giving us a hint about how to partition the data. So this example uses a very simple long type that tells us how we're going to partition the data and the data object to which partition it's going to be written to. Let's have a look at our business logic, if you want. So our business logic is very simple. It just processes the data. So it gets a data object, sets a flag that says that it was processed, and returns the result. Of course, the business logic here can be much more complex. This is just an example. The question here is, of course, you can have a look here that there is no notion of a space here. So this can be very easily tested if you want within using mock testing or something like that. Of course, if you do need a space API, we provide the ability to interact with the space interface and work with it. So what does this process data? It sets the process data to false. The question is, how do we hook it up? How do we tell the different components, which we'll see in a minute, that this will act as some kind of a listener or a listener to a data event that is initiated by the space? In this case, we're using annotations. So we use annotations in order to mark it as an event. Of course, we support XML-level declarations where you define which method names are going to be. And we also support a concrete interface that you need to implement. So it's up to the users. And this is one of the things that we're trying to achieve. It's up to the user. And the user decides, the power is in the user's hand to decide what to use and how to use it. So this is an example of a Spring XML-based configuration. And the question is, how do I hook my business logic into the fact that some change has happened? So what I'm actually trying to do is I want to be notified, or I want my listener to get to be invoked whenever a data object that is not processed gets into the system. So first of all, I define my data processor. The second thing, I'm using one of the two different containers that we provide as these common components. The name of this one is polling container, which actually uses a blocking take in order to listen to changes that are happening within the space. We give it a template. So the template in this case is a data object that its flag is set to false. This means that this container will notify our listener whenever a new data object is written into the space with its flag set to false. And we define our listener over there. In our case, it's an annotation adapter. So we're using an annotation adapter because we annotated our class with the fact that it's going to be invoked by this component. Another important thing here is we give it a reference, the GigaSpace part on the right-hand side. We give it a reference on what space it's going to work on. What is the space instance that it is going to work on? Oh, sorry. So let's have a look at a real example. Is the font okay? Can you read it? Is that okay on the back? Too small. It's time to show off the IDE. Okay, so usually when we took a typical data example, usually when you work with processing unit stuff, you got two aspects. The first one is the processor, the one that processes the data. We hook up the events, we listen to them. The other one is the feeder, the one that writes the data into the space. It's important to understand that the processor usually works with its own local space. So if it's a partitioned space, then we have 10 of them, for example. Each processor will work against its own local space. That way we get all these nice things of high performance and low latency because everything is in memory. The feeder itself the feeder doesn't know where it's going to work with. How, if it's going to work with a partition space, with primaries or backups, and how many instances. So it's writing to our clustered view of the space. Let's have a look at how this thing is happening. So we saw the examples. Just want to go over this XML. So we're using Spring XML support. So the first thing that we want to use, we want to define is we define a space. So we define what is the space, what are the characteristics of the space, some examples if it's going to work in FIFO mode or not, is it going to be persistent, a lot of the different aspects that you can configure our space with. The second thing that is defined is our own interface that is written on top of the Java Spaces spec. So the Java Spaces spec was written in 1999 or something like that. And now we have generics, we have POJOs, we have declarative transactions thanks to the fact that we're working within a Spring environment. So we provide our own simpler interface on top of this interface. Of course, you can always get it and work with it. But we provide a simpler interface that works with POJOs, doesn't have explicit transactions, so integrates seamlessly with Spring transactions, and uses generics, for example, so the template that you give it in generics, you get the results back, so you don't have to do castings and so on. And this is the polling event container that we talked about. Now, I'm a developer. Let's pass the unit test and integration test. I just want to run the system in my environment. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start a primary backup. Now, notice I didn't define anything. I didn't define within my processing unit the fact that it's going to run in a primary backup mode or something like that. Everything is external, and it's up to you to decide how it's going to run to. So I have here many examples running it in a partition mode. I'll try and run it in a primary backup scenario. So I'll start the two spaces, one of them running in a primary mode, the other one running in a backup mode. While it's loading, I want to show you the feeder part. So we wrote the feeder as another processing unit just for this example, but basically the feeder can be any Spring application context. So you can run our own components and everything within Spring very simply. Usually this will happen when you interact with a remote space. So when you interact with a remote space like a feeder, then that's the case where you use Spring natively. So you just deploy it in Tomcat or something like that. There's a web application that processes the trades, and you just write the trades or the orders into the system. So here the processing, the XML, the Spring XML that uses it, it's very, very similar. It uses a space, but in this case, it looks up the space in a Genie mode. In terms of lookup of the actual cluster of the space, and it will get all the different clusters together. We define the GigaSpace interface, which is the simplified interface that we have, and then we interact with it. So in our case, we have a simple feeder that starts up and every minute writes a data object to the space. Now you can see data is a simple POJO, and we're using our interface, which is just uses write, and that's it. So transactions, POJO support, everything is done automatically. So let's start the backup itself. These two, you don't need them. And while they're loading, start a GSUI. Okay, so we're running both a primary and a backup, and let's start the feeder. Of course, running it within the IDE uses our own integrated processing unit container, which basically means that you can take it and run it within Tomcat. You can use that in order to run the processing unit. So it can integrate with other hosting environment. Actually, our own application service grid uses this container in order to start the processing unit and deploy it. So if we start the feeder simply prints out that it's writing things, data objects into the space. It has a lot of other features. If we have time, we go into it. And we can see here that the primary itself is processing the data. And the backup is not doing anything. So if we have a look at the space itself, we'll see here that we have, let me fix this. You can see here that we have operations running against the space, many write operations without the feeder writing things to the space, and we have take operations, which are basically our polling take container that performs all the takes in order to take objects from the space. A nice example to show is if we kill this one. We'll see that now we don't have a space here. So this space basically went down. And then, and this should happen. Okay. And then you can see that basically the backup started to process everything. Immediately it started up the Spring container, started the different containers, the polling event containers, and so on. And it's now processing all the data. And the data feeder itself, it didn't lose anything. It just keeps on writing to the space. This is an example of our primary backup scenario. Now let's do an example of taking this processing unit. I haven't changed it. And now what I want to do is take this processing unit and actually deploy it into our application service grid, if you want. This is the service grid Nati talked about that knows how to read different SLAs requirements and know how to perform relocation based on failure or based on other watchable things like CPU or memory. So with the fact that we try to keep everything as a self-sufficient unit, we actually define the SLA within the processing unit. Now, of course, this can be overridden on the outside when you actually run the deploy command, but just for simplicity, you can define it here as well. So when you run the deploy, you can specify all these parameters. So here, for example, we're running two instances. Each instance will have a single backup, and we're running with a schema that is our partition sync to backup. This means that we have two partitions. Each partition has its own backup. They are sync between them. And the nice example here, number of instances per VM is one. And this is a really cool flag because it basically says, I don't want to run my primary and my backup within the same JVM because it doesn't make sense. If the JVM fails, then both of them will fail. So this flag basically says, when you deploy the system, make sure that you're running a primary and a backup in a different JVM or within a different container. So let's start our own container. So in this case, we start two containers, and then we'll start playing with it. Let's start our UI again. I closed it by mistake. Okay, so here you can see that basically what we have here is we have our own monitoring system, and you can see here on the bottom that we have two GSCs, two containers running. You can see their utilization, CPU and memory. You can see all of them here as well. We have two containers, one manager, and what we want to do is now take that processing unit that we defined and we want to deploy them into our system. So we have a simple AND command that basically deploys, we'll deploy the first one, we'll deploy the processor. See, yeah, I typed it correctly. So we're now deploying the processor into this application service grid. So you can see here basically that it starts up how many spaces. It's going to start two spaces for each, two instances of a space, if you want, within each GSC. One is the primary of the first partition. The other one is the backup of the other partition. And the other way around in the second GSC. So here you can see that basically what we can see here that we have two instances, PU1 and PU2, of data processor. One of them is the backup. The other one is the primary. Oh, man. This resolution sucks. And you can see here that we have four spaces running within our system. all of them act as a single virtualized space. This is the important part. And you can see that within the processing unit, we don't know about it. So I ran it within my IDE as a primary backup, and now I'm moving into a more real-life scenario of partitioned sync to backup. So we have these two, and let's see what happens when we deploy our... Let's see. I'm connected to the Wi-Fi. That's the problem. Okay, so basically what we see is we deployed our feeder into the system, and this thing now starts feeding data into the system, and it starts to get processed. The problem here is that I don't see it really nice, so what I can do is I can basically start another... GSC. How many times do we have? Okay. Basically start another GSC now. And now you can see that we have three GSCs. And I say, okay, I'm seeing the processing itself and the feeder itself. I'm seeing both outputs. So basically what I can do is I can take this one and just move it to the other GSCs. And now it's going to automatically relocate this processing unit, in this case the feeder. And now you can see that it's all the output of the feeder moved to this GSC, and the other GSCs are just saying, we'll process the data. And now one of the final example, which sadly I have Wi-Fi on, I forgot to turn it off, so it might break, but let's see if it works. So the other important thing is that if we kill one of them, so this is what I'm doing now, I'm killing one of the GSCs. Let's see what happens. So basically here you can see the service grid automatically detecting that the fact that something failed, it's relocating all the other services because we have another GSCs open. It's only running the feeder. So we can basically relocate all the other processing units that failed on the first container and move it to the other one. And so this is... And you can see that we continue to process the data. This one died. And that's it. Let's see what happens. Space are still coming up. Now here, in terms of the UI itself, you can see here that we have two processing units, and we can see that we have two instances of the processing unit, each actually representing a primary and a backup, and we have the feeder itself. See if the space can...
Okay. We need to move to questions, so let's wrap it up.
Yeah, do we have time? That's yep. It. Okay. So just in terms of the other components that we have within the system, let's go back to the presentation. So you saw the polling event container. The other container, of course, that we have is a notify event container, which basically uses notification in order to notify or bean. An important part of it is that I'm still writing my business logic in the same way, and the fact that I'm using a polling event container or the fact that I'm using notification, it's really up to my business case, but I'm still using the same one. So I'm basically using configuration. I can change it from a state where I'm using polling event container to a notify event container. Another cool feature, which we don't have time to show, but it's really nice, is that we took the same mechanism, the fact that we can put our own polling containers or notify containers. We actually implemented Spring Remoting on top of a space. So how many here know about Spring Remoting? Okay, so basically with Spring Remoting, you can take a service and expose it without it being known that it's going to be exposed, and expose it declaratively to run using JARX RCP or RMI or web services or Xfire and so on. So what we did is we know the space, we like the space, we know it's a fault tolerant. If we use partitioning, we get automatic load balancing. So what we did is we very easily implemented remoting. So you're using the same remoting services, you're using interfaces in order to invoke your method. The middleware itself is the space now, and it's not HTTP or TCP or something like that. The invocation itself goes through the space and goes to the correct processing unit, and we can process it easily. So this is really nice as well.
Okay, so we want to wrap up right now, and I just wanted to show the latest slide about what we're doing with Interface 21. So all that work is done collaboratively with several customers as well as Interface 21, which is deeply involved in that. And again, it will be provided as an open source kind of project, an open source community. It's not open source in the same way that you used to think about open source. It's more open source as a way for us to reach out to the community and give people the ability to contribute to that project and add their add-ons, add their own capabilities into that framework. That's pretty much the idea behind it. And I think that we have pretty much 7 minutes to get questions and hear from you what you think about it, and if you have any questions, that's pretty much the time.